loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. And it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the assassination attempt on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro this weekend while he was in the middle of Caracas delivering a speech that was live broadcast. Lots of fingers are being pointed in different ways, but who had the motivation to do this attack, and what does the aftermath look like? And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Trump administration moved today to reimpose economic sanctions against Iran. The decision raises tensions with that country and deepens the divide between the United States and Europe on Iran policy. Next, an alt-right rally in Portland, Oregon on Saturday quickly devolved into violence as fascists clashed with anti-fascist demonstrators and police. Four people were arrested, and police say they confiscated dozens of weapons and shields emblazoned with the Confederate flag from pro-fascist agitators. Attendees, though, say the police attacked only the counter-protesters, and the American Civil Liberties Union says it may sue the city on their behalf. Then, President Trump said on Sunday that a June 2016 Trump Tower meeting between top campaign aides, including Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian attorney was designed to, quote, get information on an opponent, unquote. The starkest acknowledgement yet that a statement he dictated last year about the encounter was misleading. And then the Associated Press said today that the Saudi Emirati coalition fighting Houthis in Yemen has cut secret deals with Al-Qaeda and has recruited hundreds of that group's fighters. For more than 2 years, the Saudis have bragged that they had crushed Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Meanwhile, the Saudis expelled the Canadian ambassador to Riyadh over the weekend because he criticized Saudi human rights practices. And finally, today marks the 73rd anniversary of the nuclear bomb attack on Hiroshima, Japan. Those commemorating the event in a somber ceremony in the city today called for the elimination of all nuclear weapons. An estimated 100,000 people died in the blast and subsequently from radiation poisoning. And in other headlines, Indonesia's resort island of Lombok had a 6.9 magnitude earthquake yesterday, killing 98 people. A second earthquake came today at a magnitude of 5.2, and over 120 additional aftershocks have been measured since Sunday night. More than 13,000 houses were demolished, and rescuers expect to find more people among the rubble as they clear it away. Far-right Brazilian presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro announced his running mate for the upcoming election, Reserve General Hamilton Mourão. Mourão is well known for his open calls for a military intervention into Brazil's government, considered to be a euphemism for a military coup. Meanwhile, the Workers' Party announced that former Sao Paulo Mayor Fernando Haddad would be the running mate for Lula da Silva, who, despite being the most popular politician in the country, is currently in prison and likely to be prohibited from standing in the election. Two large trucks, one carrying cars and one carrying flammable materials, collided on a bridge in Italy, sending up a fireball and causing part of the bridge to collapse. At least two people have died and 60 are injured. This took place today near Bologna Airport. Today, President Trump backed conservative Kris Kobach's bid for governor of Kansas against current Republican governor Jeff Collier. Collier advised Trump's team on immigration policy. Kobach is considered an ardent Trump supporter and was under consideration for a high-level cabinet position. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the attempted assassination of Nicolas Maduro. Six people were arrested Sunday after the assassination attempt against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro was giving a speech at a military event in Caracas when two drones, each carrying a kilo of C4 plastic explosives, flew near his podium. The military knocked one drone off course electronically. The other crashed into a nearby apartment building. The government is blaming right-wing extremists and the Colombian government for the attack. We're joined from Los Angeles by Jeanette Charles. Jeanette is a writer, editor, and solidarity liaison with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And we're joined from Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He's a writer for the same website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start first with Paul. You're there in Venezuela. First of all, what happened and what's the mood in Venezuela?
Well, as you explained, I won't go over the events again. There was a moment of uncertainty here in Venezuela. The nation is used to watching the presidential discourse, addresses on national TV. And this one was interrupted, surprisingly, in a moment of hysteria. After that, very few people knew what was going on. Very shortly after that, the vice president for communication, Jorge Rodriguez, came out again on national TV and explained to the country what had happened. No? Following that, everything's been very calm at the moment. What we do know so far is there is a small right-wing grouping which has claimed responsibility for the attack. They call themselves T-shirt soldiers. It's what they have at the moment is a Twitter account, and they sent a statement to Miami to be read on a Miami-based news network. According to their Twitter account, they're a very right-wing anti-government organization or grouping, which was set up in March 2014. And they claim responsibility for the attack. They say that we haven't now achieved our objective so far, but it's only a question of time, which leads us to think that there'll be more attacks in the future. And politically, what we know about them is they're calling for a new elections. They're calling for what they call a restoration of the constitutional order. And they're calling for a transitional government to be put in place. They've also called publicly, shortly after the attack, for Venezuelans to come onto the streets and take power. These are their words, not mine. No? And so we can presume their political line is very anti-government. But at the moment, the country is in complete calm. The government are giving and the police authorities are giving fairly regular updates on the process of the investigation. And we're waiting to find out who is behind this attack.
That's the voice of Paul Dobson. Jeanette Charles, let me read a couple sentences to you from Vice News. But I think it's the reason I want to read it is not because it's Vice News, but it's so typical of the media coverage here in the United States. Now, let's just remember, Venezuela is a member state of the United Nations. Its head of state was the target of a violent assassination attempt from the air, a bombing, basically. Here's the first two paragraphs. Six people were arrested Sunday over an apparent assassination attempt on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro using explosive-laden drones. Analysts warn the arrests are likely to be just the start of a brutal crackdown in response to the embarrassing security breach. So here you have it in the second sentence. Any arrest of the assassins or those plotting this crime, that's a brutal crackdown. And what about the security breach, the attempted killing of a head of state? It was embarrassing. Anyway, I thought it was so typical, Jeanette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're definitely correct. I mean, the media coverage in the United States, and I would say probably across corporate media, is simply, you know, it's not surprising, but it's unacceptable. And, you know, I've been in conversations with a lot of different solidarity activists, grassroots movements here in the United States and in Canada and across the region, you know, where folks are very concerned about the implications of what this means, not only for Venezuela, but also for the region as a whole, as we see kind of heightened aggression happening, whether it be, you know, still under investigation of the layers of connections involved. But it's definitely concerning to many people. And the fact that it's, you know, in many ways ridiculized in corporate media is, again, a sign of, you know, just the ways in which these different players and actors, you know, support and feed into one another and really dissuade, you know, the general public from understanding the real gravity of the situation.
One of the best was in the New York Times today. I don't know if either of you had the chance to see the New York Times, but they first said that that the Colombian president, it's near the end of his term, and he was reported to have been involved in this assassination attempt. And then they quoted an official Colombian government spokesman as saying that that was absurd. This was his word. That was absurd because the president had been attending his granddaughter's baptism at the time.
So he couldn't have actually personally operated the drone.
Precisely.
Assault.
Precisely.
That's interesting.
So we know that he wasn't operating the drone itself. At least we have that.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, on this issue, I think it's worth remembering or just worth informing your listeners that this very same president, Juan Manuel Santos, 6 days before the assassination attempt, made some public declarations about Venezuela and about Maduro. No? So what did he say in these public declarations? Well, he said that he saw the end of Maduro's mandate being, I quote, close. He said, I quote, I hope it's even tomorrow. He also said that Colombia, I quote, would be willing and ready to help in any way possible, in making reference to the end of Maduro's mandate. Now, Maduro was just recently elected three months ago. He has a mandate for 6 years. So when a neighboring president says that he hopes that his mandate finishes tomorrow, and then 6 days later, there is a bomb attack against that president, obviously people start connecting the dots. Now, I've seen no evidence, I've seen no proof that Santos was involved. Maduro has made the claim. No? And at the moment, it's purely coincidental. But there's a strong correlation, we can say. It'd be very interesting to see that the Venezuelan government publish any evidence that they find directly collecting Juan Manuel Santos, maybe not driving the drone, but maybe financing the drone, which cost about $5,000 each, or in other ways, I don't know. But it'd be interesting to see that the Venezuelan government publish any sort of evidence they have connecting Santos to this attack, if they have some.
Yeah, and Jeanette, the other thing that we were all talking about here earlier today is how, again, I want to go back to the media just for a moment. Maybe we don't need to talk about it that much because it's so obvious. But again, for our listeners who may just be getting their news from the corporate-owned media, most of the media was kind of mocking the Venezuelan army for, quote, running away. And that was the big takeaway, not that the head of state was being targeted for an assassination. But like, what were the soldiers supposed to do if they're on the street and there's like explosive devices coming down on them? You're supposed to, I don't know, John, you say you get off the X.
At the CIA, they taught us get off the X. That means run for your life. That's what you're supposed to do. If you just stand there, you're going to die. Just get off the X.
Yeah. But Jeanette, it was amazing. The media coverage was just mocking. That was the big takeaway, mocking the soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, too, is just to remind listeners is that that was a commemorative event. You know, these were not necessarily soldiers who were prepared to, as you say, you know, engage in some sort of combat. But folks were there as part of a commemorative ceremony. So, you know, and as you mentioned, there is training protocol. And of course, if things are falling from the sky, you're going to run. You know, and it's not to say that people don't have pride in their country or want to defend their nation at all, but it means, you know, in that moment, there's certain, you know, if you have two options, you stand there and you could possibly get hurt, injured, or die, or you try to run to safety and then assess the situation. But as you mentioned, yeah, it's another, you know, just telltale sign of the way corporate media is trying to spin this entire situation to actually pull away from the, you know, concerning moment, which is this attempted assassination.
I want to ask both of you about the history of coup making in Venezuela, because there was a coup in 2002 and Chavez was taken from power but restored to power by the mobilization of the people, especially poor people. At that time, the Chavista said the U.S. was behind that coup. I want to go back with both of you to talk about what happened then. Was the U.S. involved in that coup? And is the U.S. involved in any way in this coup now? Go ahead, Paul.
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? at the time in 2002, there were accusations floating around, which at that time were accusations. Very shortly afterwards, they were proved to be true. No? Numerous U.S. Researchers, investigators, as well as Venezuelans, looked further into the deeds of 2002. They did find that the U.S. was involved, and not just the U.S., but also the Colombian and the Spanish governments. So in this context, we have to look at the current accusations which are being made against Colombia. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not, but time will tell. History has shown that when the Venezuelan government, Bolivarian government, has made accusations of a similar nature, they have, at least in 2002, turned out to be true. No? So I think it's very important that we understand things in this context. Over to you, Jeanette.
Yeah, and Jeanette, tell the audience or help the audience, in addition to answering the question, what happened in 2002?
Well, you know, just to echo what Paul is saying, is I don't think it's ahistoric or unreasonable to accuse or believe and know that the U.S. and allies may have a level or have designed or are pushing to execute a coup or any sort of intervention in Venezuela or anywhere else really that is attempting to create an alternative model to what we know exists in the U.S., you know, in terms of thinking about global capital, et cetera. Venezuela is a very huge threat to U.S. hegemony, not just in Latin America and the Caribbean, but globally. And so when people are looking at this assassination attempt, you know, which unfortunately will probably be one of many different things that we see in terms of heightened aggression towards Venezuela in the coming weeks and months, as we've seen in the last 5 years, for example, with just Maduro's presidency, you know, to always frame it within that history of, you know, U.S. interventionism across the region in Haiti and Guatemala and Grenada and Nicaragua and, you know, even in next door Colombia, the conflict and history of Colombia is very much rooted in U.S. interventionism. And then in terms of the 2002 coup against Chavez, you know, we saw Chavez taken from the presidential palace. I know many of your listeners probably have seen The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which is a very incredible and impressive documentary that captures, you know, these very tense moments during which, you know, Chavez is taken from power and you see Carmona come into power. You see a lot of right-wing Venezuelan opposition members such as Leopoldo López and others who, you know, kind of have a higher profile at that time. And you see the people of Venezuela, you know, working class, majority black and indigenous folks of you know, ancestry, fight back and say that, you know, they voted for President Chavez, that he has the right to carry out his democratic term. And you also see the Venezuelan military also collaborating with the people, which is part of this history of like the civic military union that we see so uniquely characteristic of Venezuela.
Paul Dobson, where are things going in Venezuela? I mean, there's obviously been a lot of economic suffering, high inflation, dislocation. The U.S. government has said all options are on the table. Earlier, before Trump, even Obama had said Venezuela posed a national security threat to the United States, which is seems to be laying the rhetorical, at least, pretext for a deeper U.S. intervention. Has something like this strengthened the hand of Maduro and the forces aligned with him? Does it weaken it? Does it make him appear to be more vulnerable? And of course, the population itself is polarized into different camps. Just how do you think it plays out, at least in the coming days or weeks, if you have a sense of that?
Well, I think firstly for Maduro is, to some extent, it's played a little bit into his hand. It's allowed him to take the moral high ground and rally his forces behind him amongst a very generic ethos, which is we don't use violence for political means. We've seen statements come out in the last 48 hours from governments which wouldn't normally get involved in Venezuelan politics, but they've made statements in support of Maduro and in support of this ethos. No? So the rallying of the forces behind him will definitely strengthen his position to some extent. No? I think it's also to look at the opposition in Venezuela, which has to some extent divided over their interpretation of this attack. There are elements within the Venezuelan opposition, which are maybe not vocalized by leaders or political parties, which would have supported an action like this. You know, the more extremist elements. Some of the right-wing politicians have condemned it. No? Others have avoided any sort of comment, and others have said, you know, well, we have to force them out without saying yes or no in favor of this sort of strategy. So there's been a massive division within the opposition, a further division, which exemplifies the increasing divisions within the Venezuelan opposition we've seen in the last year or so, between a camp which wants to participate in democratic life, wants to hold elections, wants to try to win within all the democratic norms that you'd expect, and a different camp which says, if we do this, we're going to lose, therefore we shouldn't. We should go onto the streets, we should throw bombs, and we should try to kill him. And the division between this camp has been exemplified by the May 20 election. So we saw where some elements decided to participate in the elections and some elements didn't. So I think the overall picture from this attack will be a rallying of forces behind the government and further chaos within the opposition groupings. It's worth pointing out that in a few months we have more elections in Venezuela, yet another electoral process, which is for local councils. So at the moment, opposition parties are trying to decide who is going to participate and who is not going to participate in these elections. And I think this debate will have an impact on this.
That's the voice of Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're speaking to him from Venezuela, and we're also speaking with Jeanette Charles from Los Angeles. Jeanette is the writer, editor, and solidarity liaison with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. People should actually go out of your way to go to that website. If you're relying only on the corporate-owned American media, you will know nothing, or you will know worse than nothing. You will have disinformation about what's going on. But go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com to really get updated, well-researched, factual information that gives you the other side of the story. Jeanette, I want to ask you about the process itself. Venezuela is very, I would say it's a very unique revolutionary process. When you think of Cuba, you can say on January 1st, 1959, the July 26th movement seized the power. It went through different stages after 1959 and throughout that year. Or if you think about the Chinese Revolution, the Chinese revolutionaries took power formally October 1st, 1949. There was a day, there was a moment when power was transitioned and transformed. The same with the Russian Revolution. But this isn't a day or a moment. It's really this ongoing, complicated process. And as a consequence, the revolutionary forces have ebbs and flows in terms of their own strength and enduring, and seemingly in some ways, intractable problems, because Venezuela isn't like an island unto itself. It lives as part of a global world economy. And thus, the revolutionary process, the revolutionary forces are constantly tested once again and once again. And I want to have our audience understand how this has impacted on the consciousness of the base for the revolution, say for working class and poor people who have been the main beneficiaries of and the main advocates, the main motor force for this process. Talk about that, if you would. And also, if you wouldn't mind helping us understand what's, I think, known as the civic military alliance and what impact that has in the face of right-wing opposition.
Well, as you mentioned, you capture it really well in that the base of the revolutionary process, women, young people, working class, poor, indigenous, Afro-Venezuelans are really at the center, at the root of this revolutionary process that, you know, for many people is marked by 1999 and, you know, the Chavez coming into power, but is also marked by the Caracazo and like a massive rebellion against, you know, the height of neoliberalism in 1989. But you can, you know, if you look at different historians and the way people in Venezuela talk about their process, it has roots in the commune at the turn of the 20th century and has roots in the pre-independence era and Simon Bolivar and, you know, Negro Miguel and Guaycaipuro and kind of all these different, leaders that make up this bigger collective political imagination and history, ancestors who fought for change, for sovereignty, for self-determination. And Venezuela, I think, does come at a particularly unique moment, both as an oil-dependent and oil-producing nation, but also in a unique moment in the history of global capital and what it means and what it's challenging. So, you know, for everyday Venezuelans who are Chavista or everyday Venezuelans who are building their revolutionary process in different ways, you know, this does not go amiss. People understand that their role is very historic, not just in their own national process, but also for South America, for the Caribbean, for the entire world. And that's something I think, you know, at Venezuela Now in particular, we do try and capture in terms of how people understand their own process, how they grapple with the internal contradictions, how they grapple with, you know, the relationship that is often tumultuous but sometimes harmonious between the state and the movements. And, you know, we do a lot of documentation of campesinos and farmers and feminist movements and all these folks who are really utilizing this revolutionary process that's occurring both at a grassroots level and a state level to push forward new, you know, types of, you know, you could say non-reformist reforms or, you know, revolutionary laws and things like that to really radically change their society in ways that I think is very inspiring for a lot of different movements in the world today that are up against, you know, even bigger monsters and bigger challenges sometimes. And then in terms of the civic military union, is I think it's important, you know, for folks who are listening to know that because of the history of the ways in which, you know, Chavez himself was a military leader, respected as both president and a military leader, right, had a type of reverence and influence within the military world in Venezuela to the extent that, you know, he really intentionally and carefully tried to rectify some of the historical wrongs that, you know, the Venezuelan military had been trained to orchestrate against its own people. And so, you know, you'll see now that there's, you know, it's very unlikely that one day the military, particularly during this revolutionary process, may turn on the Venezuelan people to the extent that you'll see widespread repression as you would in places like Honduras or Colombia or, you know, even with the newly instated police force in Haiti, right? Because they've been trained by the United States. They've been trained by, you know, global mercenaries and paramilitary forces. And in Venezuela, that's not necessarily the case because there is some sort of resonance between both the people, the working class, and their military forces.
I want to ask both of you, too, about the issue of sanctions. This is something that we only see in fits and starts here in the U.S. press, and I'm talking specifically about the U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. You both are on record as pointing out that sanctions hurt the average Venezuelan on the street. Sanctions take food out of the mouths of Venezuelan children. They don't necessarily hurt governments. What are you doing to bring awareness to this issue and to work to get these sanctions lifted? Go ahead, Jeanette, since it's your issue.
Sure. Well, currently there is an emerging campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela. And while the emphasis is really put on, you know, understanding how these sanctions affect everyday Venezuelans, regardless of their political affiliation, et cetera, you know, and also highlighting that they do harm the state in being able to actually exercise sovereignty and economic determination, you know, some of the work that's happening is having U.S.-based and Canadian-based organizations call out the illegality of these sanctions that are illegal. They're unilateral economic measures, coercive economic measures that are illegal under the OAS, the Organization of American States, and the United Nations. And we know, I've been on your program before, we've talked about the complicated nature of the OAS and how it's related to Venezuela, but sanctions are illegal under these two particular charters of the OAS, the United Nations. You know, we also are talking to folks about how sanctions in many ways are a prelude to war and military intervention. And, you know, this recent assassination attempt, you know, we still don't know all the details, but in thinking about the way that economic sanctions, you know, a global corporate media smear campaign against the revolutionary process in Maduro and now an assassination attempt, you know, are all part of a larger plan and a larger architecturally crafted plan against Venezuela's process and its sovereignty. And so the sanctions, you know, the anti-sanctions campaign directly talks about that and speaks about this. And the ways in which people are asked to get involved, there's right now a circulating call to action that people can find on the Alliance for Global Justice website, AFGJ, as folks probably know. And also, we are asking folks to get involved by either participating in International Days of Action, which are coming up on August 14th, which is the one-year mark from when President Donald Trump in the United States announced tightened sanctions against Venezuela, also casually referred to a military option on the table, which now we know in recent news is much more than just a military option, but having wanted to seek out more direct military intervention at the time. And also, you know, people are also invited to participate in different educational activities, legislative lobbying, both in Canada and the United States, as well as international solidarity delegations and statements in support of the Venezuelan people and against sanctions, and also more recently against this assassination attempt.
That's Jeanette Charles with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul Dobson is also joining us from Venezuela. Paul, we're going to give you the last word. We have 2 minutes left. Two quick things. And again, in the U.S. media, they're referring to this assassination attempt as people carried out by people they say supported the helicopter protest at the Supreme Court, which really floored all of us because It's illegal in the United States, in Washington, where we are, to even have a protest at the Supreme Court, much less drop bombs on it from a helicopter. But nonetheless, it's characterized in the U.S. media by the Washington Post as a helicopter protest. I just wanted to say that again because it's so outrageous. But in our last 90 seconds, we're almost a year to the day where the Constituent Assembly was elected. That was a new form of power and involvement and engagement, or certainly that was the goal of it. How meaningful is the Constituent Assembly? You get the final word.
Well, regarding the attack on the Supreme Court, yes, a helicopter attack in any other part of the world on a government institution or a power of state would be a terrorist attack. It has been announced that two of the people who have been arrested for Saturday's drone attack have links to the terrorist cell which carried out the Supreme Court attack. So there is definitely a connection there. It's also worth pointing out that President Maduro in June decided to pardon a number of people who were being processed for such crimes and release them. 79 opposition activists who were being processed for violent political crimes were released onto the streets. 2 months later, he almost gets killed. I'll let your listeners draw their own conclusions there. And with regard to the National Constituent Assembly, the general feeling amongst Venezuelans is they're waiting for the draft constitution to come out and come to light. They elected this assembly to draw up a new constitution, and that's what they want to see, and people want to vote on this. There's currently a big debate about what should go in it and what shouldn't go in it. For example, the question of abortion, whether that should be included or not, the legalization of abortion. But as yet, the general feeling is that the National Constituent Assembly isn't doing the job it was designed to do, and people are demanding more from this body.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Paul Dobson. We talked to him from Venezuela. He's with VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Again, we're urging people to go to the website. And also Jeanette Charles, same website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Jeanette was talking to us from Los Angeles. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined once again from New Haven, Connecticut by Chris Garaffa. Chris is a web developer and technologist. Chris Garaffa, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hey, Brian and John, great to be back. Happy Monday to you.
Thank you. And again, a number of really, really big stories. Some of them we started to cover last week, but we want to go a little bit more in depth. Let's talk about the new partnership between Facebook and the Atlantic Council and the FBI to determine whose pages on Facebook are real or valid and who should be purged.
Right. So last week we had spoken about Facebook removing a number of pages, mostly progressive leaning pages, claiming that they were, or insinuating really, that they were linked to some sort of Russian activity, never coming out and saying that directly, but their statement really, really tried to drive that point home. We found out that one of Facebook's partners in this so-called fact-checking is the Atlantic Council, which is kind of a think tank. But we took a look into who the Atlantic Council actually is and who its supporters are and who its members are. And this list is a global who's who of mega capitalism. The United Arab Emirates has donated over $1 million. Adrian Arsht, who is she's a philanthropist, but she is worth like $30 million because her father owned a bank, and then she was on the board of that bank. You've got the Airbus Group. You've got Chevron. You've got Raytheon and Qualcomm on here, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan, and it goes on and on. There are banks, there are oil companies, there are weapons and technology companies. I don't see any community groups represented. I don't see any progressive organizations represented. So this is who Facebook has decided to partner with, at least in part, to police what they consider fake news or do their fact checking on the platform. And it really is very concerning that this is the organization that they've decided to go with. This organization represents, as I said, the millionaire and billionaire classes, the most wealthy countries and institutions and people, instead of the average people who are using Facebook to share and get their news.
Chris, let me ask you, how is a decision like this made? Facebook is a publicly traded company. Presumably it has to answer to its shareholders. Not all the shares are owned by Mark Zuckerberg after all. So how is something like this determined, and what would make Facebook think that this would placate people?
Well, they didn't make a big deal out of who the partner was. They just wanted to talk about how they were addressing the situation. At this point, because of all of the outcry, all of the anger from people about pages being taken down, about fake news, and all of these things that people are talking about on Facebook, after the stock effectively crashed, over the past past week and a half, Facebook has been on a PR blast. They have been putting up billboards. They've been putting up signs. I was on the train here in Connecticut and saw they have billboards up and signs at the train stations. And they've had these for a little while, but they're really increasing their presence now, trying to say that Facebook is for friends, that you can trust Facebook and all of that. I don't think they're expecting people to check into who they actually are partnering with, whether it's this private think tank or the FBI or whoever else they're working with. And I think the board is just going to be happy with them getting their stock back up. The board isn't really concerned with the morality or the truth. The board is concerned with getting their stock back up and to increase their own wealth.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. Again, we're talking about Facebook deciding what pages are real and what profiles are real and taking them down. And in order to show that they have partners, Facebook is partnering with the Atlantic Council. And I was looking at the Washington Post and the other corporate-owned mainstream media, and there was no questioning within the press reports about this partnership with the Atlantic Council, as if the Atlantic Council could somehow be the true, representative of what's true and a true representative of the people, and somehow a constraint on Facebook as opposed to simply sort of, a window dressing designed to give it credibility. I don't think you mentioned, Chris, that among the big donors, that is the donors to the Atlantic Council who gave between $250,000 and $1 million, it includes NATO. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is a military alliance, which is identifying other countries like Russia as an adversary, or, other countries as well. And of course, the United States itself has identified Russia and China as the primary adversaries for major power confrontation as part of the new national security doctrine or strategy that was released last January. Then you have Raytheon, you have Boeing, Chevron Oil. It's amazing that the media, that the corporate-owned media doesn't immediately stop and say, how could it be that NATO, the United Arab Emirates, Chevron, Raytheon, which brings us the cruise missiles, Boeing, and these other military contractors should be on their face disqualified as any sort of neutral party here?
They're not looking for neutral parties. They are looking for partisan parties here, and that's I think why they chose this. They want to be respected in the financial world and give the illusion that they are, that Facebook, they are a trusted source. And we should also mention that the U.S., the Pentagon has given over $100,000. They just split it up, so it's hidden down in the $25,000 range between the Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, and Navy. So they split up their at least $100,000 donation between those four parts of the armed forces. So we can see, and this list is just so long, if people should, scroll through it, it's so long about who has given money here. But I think it's a completely transparent move by Facebook to reassure their investors and bring their stock price and their net worth back up.
And I also see that one of the recent big initiatives of the Atlantic Council, again, guaranteeing that we don't see fake news, is the extremely angry indictment of Republican Senator Rand Paul, who had the temerity to insist that John Brennan, former CIA director, have his security clearance pulled. And of course, I don't think most people realize that these former heads of U.S. intelligence agencies keep their security clearance and thus access the information, but then use it, as Brennan's using it, to go on as paid contributors, as highly paid contributors to corporate-owned media, as if they're then impartial experts. That's a whole other. I mean, this, when you look at the whole thing as it plays out, far from draining the swamp, Washington D.C. and this political establishment is an unadulterated swamp. Trump isn't draining it, but the Democrats, the Republicans, the lobbyists, the 15,000 lobbyists who constitute really the shadow government in the United States. Call it what you will, but swamp seems to fit.
I'd agree, and I think the swamp is it's the opposite of draining. It's just getting bigger and bigger and taking up more space. So we should point out that this that the Atlantic Council is not just, you know, it's just one of these many, many legislative lobbying bodies and think tanks. Another one is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that many people talked about, especially during the Occupy movement, and which got to, you know, a high profile and had donors and members like, you know, Walmart, and was responsible for keeping wages down, responsible for fighting at any kind of minimum wage increase or labor rights in the United States. And so this is just, the Atlantic Council is just one of many of these organizations that's doing this work, and it's just outside, again, of the realm of technology.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talked to Chris, who is a technologist, every Monday about some of the big stories in the world of technology. I'm looking at another article that's from the Wall Street Journal today, Chris. Again, when we talk about Facebook as being the monitor of what's good and what's true, in other words, that they're this benign overlord of the social media platform and they're trying to protect us from fake news. Here's the headline. Facebook to banks, give us your data, we'll give you our users. And then the subtitle, Facebook has asked large U.S. banks to share detailed financial information about customers as it seeks to boost user engagement. And then I want to read a couple paragraphs to you and then have you comment. Again, this is like, if people don't read the Wall Street Journal, and most people don't read the Wall Street Journal, they won't know this story. They'll just be reading about the headlines about Facebook clamping down on fake news. But here we go. The social media giant has asked large U.S. banks to share detailed financial information about their customers, including card transactions and checking account balances, as part of an effort to offer new services to users. Facebook increasingly wants to be a platform where people buy and sell goods and services besides connecting with friends. The company over the past year asked JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and U.S. Bancorp to discuss potential offerings it could host for a bank for bank customers on Facebook Messenger, said people familiar with the matter. I mean, Chris, that's behind the scenes. These are going to be agreements between the banks who we bank with, because, you know, you have to put your money somewhere. These bankers are in negotiations, which up until now have been secret negotiations with Facebook, about whether to share our customer, our bank information, including the amount of money we have in our checking accounts and our savings accounts, with Facebook so that it can, quote, offer new services. I mean, wow, that's a big story, but again, not a big story.
It should be much bigger. I would say this should be covered on the nightly news every night this week, but it's certainly not going to be. Facebook ultimately is not a social network. It's a data company that created a social network in order to facilitate its data collection. It wants this information on us so that it can target us for ads. It can sell our information to advertisers to better target, because the more specific you can get with a target audience, the more money you can ask for that ad. So if they want to target, you know, people who have a certain amount of money in their bank account in a certain age range, then an advertiser can do that. And Facebook can say, we can do this now. We can get down to people who spent money on food takeout or people who spent, you know, a certain amount of money at any store or series of stores. Walmart can target people who spend money at Target or vice versa. But Facebook is going to have this information, and who knows what they're going to do with it. And that's the problem, is that there's going to be no transparency as to where it goes, as to how it's stored, as to whether or not it's secure enough, and how it's going to be used in order to target us as individuals, as users of Facebook, and how it's going to be used to try to manipulate our emotions, which, as we know, is what Facebook does with its algorithms deciding what we see, not just in ads, but with posts as well. So Facebook is going to be using all this data in ways that we don't know unless somebody comes out from behind the scenes and tells us, we would encourage someone from Facebook to do that. Tell us how they're using this information. Tell us what their plans are, because we have a right to know, because the information is our information. It should not belong to Facebook.
And that's really all what it always comes down to, is this information and ownership of the information, and frankly, protection of the information as well. You know, we've said on the show, Chris Garofa has said on this show, that Facebook doesn't do what it does out of the goodness of its collective heart. It does it because it's a money-making enterprise, and they make that money by selling our personal information.
Yeah, and let's talk just for a moment. Let's diverge for a moment and go back to the subject we talked about last week. And why this happened, that the Facebook stock lost $118 billion overnight. Mark Zuckerberg lost one-fifth of his wealth overnight, which meant that he was, I think, down to $120 billion. Chris, you explained to us, why suddenly did investors panic and start to drop Facebook stock?
So part of it was that they announced the first decrease in the number of active monthly users in some regions. Which, you know, as we said last year, there's only so many people in the world and only so many that have access to the internet. And so they should have seen that coming a very long time ago. But if there are fewer people who are active, there are fewer people who are viewing advertisements. At the same time, there was all this outrage and still is all this outrage about the privacy scandals and the removing of pages and, you know, the so-called fake news. And investors don't necessarily care about that. They just care about the fact that there's outrage and that's impacting people's view of Facebook. And so there are two reasons then why the stock went down. First, it's they're looking at the next quarter, maybe the next two quarters of revenue. They get that revenue from advertisement, and that was going to go down slightly because they had slightly fewer monthly active users. And also this anger at the company over how it's approaching what sources it has, what pages and news sources it allows on the site.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook makes a lot of money by showing a wide variety of content and collecting data about the people who are watching it or engaging with it. And those are the things that have become, you know, somewhat under scrutiny, well, real scrutiny in the last months. So the unlimited capacity of Facebook to collect data on people unwittingly and then to sell it to advertisers or to sell it for advertisements. That's the real, I mean, just because there was a little peek behind the curtain about how Facebook really functions, it seems that really has had this huge impact. But, you know, here's another thing, Chris, and we've talked about this, but because you are the technologist, I want to talk to you about how Facebook really is a super powerful, potentially super powerful instrument for advertisers or campaigners if they have enough money. And again, this was an issue that came up a lot because the government, the Congress, the House and Senate Republicans and Democrats were pulling Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook over the coals for not, quote, taking seriously the Russian influence in the 2016 election. And then Facebook, which had first said, no, it's not really a big deal, they came out and said, yes, it was a big deal. and the Internet Research Agency paid $80,000 for ads, 56% of which came after the election. But John and I were talking last week because we were also reviewing stories where the Trump administration or the Trump campaign before it was the Trump administration, when they had a social media budget, they spent almost all of it on Facebook, almost $90 billion, somewhere between $70 and $90 billion. And a huge amount of what was spent was designed for very micro-targeted voter suppression efforts. And when you look at why the Democrats actually lost to Donald Trump, well, actually they won because they got 3 million more votes. It was the Electoral College. But 6 million Democrats did not vote who voted last time. Now, partly because Hillary Clinton is an awful candidate, and partly because they didn't want to go to war again, and she was just kind of offering more of the same. But this voter suppression effort was very interesting. The Trump Facebook team was sending these A-B test messages, not test message, A-B messages, meaning here's one version, A version, and B, a slightly different version, to historically Democratic Party constituents, black communities and young voters in the swing states. And they were basically just offering up negative advertising. So there was a big effort to use Hillary Clinton's racist words about young black men being super predators and then doing animations about it and sending it only to black voters, not to white voters, in order to make black people who had in the past voted Democratic or voted for Barack Obama not come out this time. Anyway, when Obama did the same kind of micro-targeting, it was, you know, described as a great new revolution in campaigning. But it's actually a very serious effort to impede any kind of genuine democracy if you have enough money, which the two parties have enough money to do, to manipulate the population. And negative ads work better than positive ads in terms of people sort of drifting towards them.
That's right. I was actually having a conversation with somebody over the weekend about the whole Russia situation. Somebody who, you know, sees kind of, you know, mass media coverage of it. And they said, well, Russia, you know, Russia had all these Facebook posts and all these ads. And I said, well, they spent, you know, well under what the two campaigns did. The Trump campaign, you know, spent many, you know, dozens in the Clinton campaign as well, dozens of millions of dollars. Just on social media posts, actually just on Facebook posts. Now, can you, and I said to my friend here, I said, can you, as an ordinary person, spend that kind of money to get your point of view out? And of course, the answer was no. So the discussion came to, how is this really democracy if these companies are allowing these campaigns, these companies, these think tanks to take out millions and millions of dollars of advertisements that are just meant to impact us? When the average person doesn't have that option. So it's a real question of democracy. And outside the question of Russia, it's, you know, what kind of democracy do we really have in the U.S.? And it's a two-party, one-system democracy, effectively. The two parties representing wings of the same system that have different approaches to their goals, but really with shared goals. And all these social media companies, these advertising companies are part of that same system and are complicit and enable that degradation of democracy.
Yeah, the Republicans had the Republican social media operation during the 2016 campaign produced 100,000 pieces of content for Facebook. And again, people didn't know in many instances where the content was coming from because they created so many pages. And the Democrats, again, do the same. So they create an image of where the content is coming from. It's micro-targeting towards the population. And again, for the Trump campaign, it was $70 to $90 million that was spent on it with his micro-targeting. And the Republicans had, according to their own estimates, they had data on 220 million Americans, 4,000 to 5,000 data points per person on average. About that means everything you've said, you've clicked on, you've purchased, you know, you've invested on, any video you've looked at. I mean, an enormous amount of data, again, purchased by people who have the money. And so when you look at it and think about the issue of fake news, if you think about fake news without taking into account how this kind of sort of advertising influencing efforts are underway by those with money, either the biggest corporations who want to sell us things, or governments that have a lot of power, or political campaigns that whose coffers are filled up mainly with the money also of billionaires. You don't really get a sense of, you know, what it means to have fake news or manipulated news or the shaping of public opinion. It's really critically important to understand this stuff.
It absolutely is.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. He joins us every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa. Chris, every week you end with a technology tip. We have about 2 minutes left. Give us your technology tip.
Well, Brian and John, I got a little more bad news for you. You did not win the internet lottery, and there is no wealthy widower or Nigerian prince who wants to give you millions of dollars for your assistance. I want to help people stay safe when it comes to these email scams. First, if it sounds too good to be true, it is too good to be true. Always check, you know, the spelling and grammar of these things. They actually purposely use bad spelling and grammar to try to trick people into thinking that they're real, which seems backwards, but it's been scientifically proven. If you get an email from a company that you use saying you need to reset your password, don't click the link that they send you. Actually, go and type it in yourself in your web browser, because that way you can be sure they're not hiding a fake page behind that link. It can look exactly like it's coming from PayPal, for example, but it takes you to a fake site that looks like PayPal. So type it in yourself and don't just give anyone your password because they sent you an email. And that is the tech tip for this week.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. We were joined by Chris Garaffa. Chris is a technologist from New Haven, Connecticut. The name of this segment is Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa. Every week we take a look at the big technology stories of the week. And also every week, Chris gives us, the people, the listeners, a technology tip to be more effective and, of course, to be more safe and secure. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.